And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And we're going to get on into our commentary for today. This is a global overview of genetically modified trees based on a study by the World Wildlife Fund. Based on a preliminary study, there have been 116 confirmed field trials involving at least 24 tree species that have been subject to transgenic modification and released into the environment in 17 countries since 1988. The survey incorporated tree species for both fruit and timber production, although 76% fell into the timber production category. The first confirmed record of a wild release of a genetically modified tree species is that of a poplar in Ghent, Belgium in 1988. The first half of the 1990s witnessed a modest growth in research trials that never exceeded 5 per year. However, over the same period, biotechnologists had extended their trials to incorporate 11 tree species, although they continued to focus on a narrow range of traits, namely herbicide resistance and pest and disease resistance. The latter half of the 1990s has seen an exponential increase in the number of trials and in the number of species tested. In 1998 alone, the last year sampled, there were 44 new trials, an increase of more than 50% on the cumulative total of all preceding genetically modified tree trials. While there are many similarities between environmental threats posed by transgenic trees and those from genetically modified agricultural crops, those being genetic pollution, invasiveness, effects on biodiversity, and so on, there are also important issues which have largely been ignored. The first is that the time and location factor, i.e. the trees as crops, are long-lived perennials, often located in remote areas where constant vigilance against unanticipated problems is difficult, if not impossible. GM forests may be managed in the centers of origin or close to natural species, increasing the likelihood of cross-pollination. Two, the effect transgenic trees will have on long-term site productivity and the potential threat posed by international trade in transgenic roundwood to forest certification. Number three, trees are likely to be keystone species in their environment and support more biodiversity than agricultural crops. Four, unlike agricultural crops, trees have not been subject to the same degree of domestication, and research and more knowledge regarding the biology and ecology of tree species is inadequate. More independent research is needed into tree biology, forest ecology, and the time and location factors. Number five, the vast majority of current field trials only examine the direct effects of the manipulated traits. Wider questions concerning the environmental impact of accelerated growth or completely sterile trees are not considered, yet it may be that these associated risks are more likely to occur. This is a common feature in the history of land use intensification and therefore pose the greatest ecological threats. By far and away, the largest number of genetically modified tree releases via field trials has taken place in the United States and Canada, 61% of the worldwide total. Between 1998 and 1999, 71 confirmed releases have taken place. All but one of the confirmed North American releases have taken place in the United States, and by far the majority of these, over 56%, are located in Oregon, California, and Washington states. 10 other states, primarily in the Northeast, have also established trials. Like Europe, the majority of trials are under the auspices of government or academic research institutions, and only 13% are directly under the control of four private sector companies, Union Camp, Westvaco, Weyerhaeuser, and Monsanto. Interestingly, compared with Europe, there has been a marked difference in terms of modified traits. The majority of the releases in Canada and the U.S. have been designed to evaluate insect or disease resistance, 53%, and herbicide tolerance, 17%. There appears to be limited interest in traits such as sterility, only 4% of the releases, although engineered sterility is often used by genetic modification proponents as an example of how the industry has built environmental safeguards into their trials. There has also been a more limited species range being tested than in Europe. Only 8 tree species have been confirmed as being transgenic, and of these three are fruit trees. Half of all trials have been on poplar species, followed by American black walnut, 14%. 4 trials of papaya have been released in Hawaii, and finally, 80% of all trials in North America have been released since 1995. Over the past 4 years, several important joint ventures between forestry and biotech companies have been formed, While the formation of these consortia have passed relatively unnoticed, their significance should not be underestimated, for it represents a transition of forest biotechnology from minor to major leagues. It has become increasingly difficult to determine how the genetically modified issue will unfold over the next 18 months. Indeed, many may argue that the whole GM issue is a dead duck, that many companies have had their fingers well and truly burnt with the commercialization of the technology and will now leave it alone. Recent reports that Monsanto is considering pulling GM trials out of the United Kingdom would seem to indicate that the high-profile campaign conducted by Greenpeace and others is set to result in a decisive victory. But such conclusions are ill-considered, for while some biotechnology companies have suffered a number of setbacks in recent months, most notably from falling stock prices, neither the science of biotechnology nor the opportunities to commercialize innovation will go away. This has been recognized by many governments and may partly explain why a populist British government has on this issue its face so firmly against a public which mistakenly believes that GM food crops pose a greater health risk than BSE. Governments are sure that biotechnology is one of the industries of the future and are particularly anxious not to lose the innovation race to other countries. And this has been the results of a study from the World Wildlife Fund. And I wanted to mention here that the Forest Service is proposing recreation in the Ashland Wilderness. The Forest Service is proposing to expand the Mount Ashland ski area into the inventoried McDonald Peak roadless area above the city of Ashland, Oregon. The expansion would clear-cut 13 new ski runs that, if stacked end-to-end, total 5 miles in length. It would also include new chairlifts, a mid-mountain lodge, and a bigger parking lot. The new ski runs would fragment the upper portion of the McDonald Peak roadless area, a crucial wildlife migration corridor between the Cascades and the Siskiyou Mountains. The roadless area features 400-year-old Shasta red fir forests that support critical recovery habitat for spotted owls and lynx. A nesting spotted owl pair is known to hunt in an area that would be cleared for a ski run. According to independent biologists, the McDonald Peak roadless area must be protected to save many endangered plant and animal species from extinction. Of course, there's the possibility for degraded drinking water. There are some rare plants that are endangered, and the area doesn't really get all that much snow. It's going to require 108,000 additional skier visits after the expansion to cover the costs, including depreciation and interest. It doesn't seem to be economically viable, and it certainly isn't biologically viable. What can you do? Well, the Forest Service will accept public comments on its proposal until May 4th. Your comments are very important to the outcome of the planning process. A large number of letters can change the alternatives that are being considered. Be sure to tell them, stay out of the East Fork of Ashland Creek watershed, stay out of the McDonald Peak roadless area, avoid impacts to endangered species and rare plants, and improve the existing facilities instead of expanding them. Here's the address. Please write to Linda Duffy, Ashland District Ranger, 645 Washington Street, Ashland, Oregon, 97520. Once again, that address, Linda Duffy, D-U-F-F-Y, Ashland District Ranger, 645 Washington Street, Ashland, Oregon, 97520. Or send email to srjohnson at fs.fed.us. That's srjohnson, all one word, at fs.fed.us. And if you'd like more information, contact the Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands, P.O. Box 332 in Williams, Oregon, 97544. That's Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands, P.O. Box 332, Williams, Oregon, 97544. Give them a call, 541-846-9273. That's 541-846-9273. Or Lininger, L-I-N-I-N-G-E-R, at EFN.org. And, of course, their webpage is kswild.org. Doesn't seem to be any triple W in there, so just kswild.org. And in a notable victory for dolphins, U.S. Federal District Judge Felton Henderson has denied the Clinton administration's attempt to loosen standards for the Dolphin Safe Tuna label. The administration had attempted to advance its trade-free agenda, or its free trade agenda, by allowing Mexican tuna caught by dolphin deadly methods to bear the distinctive blue dolphin-safe label when sold in the U.S. While this relaxation of standards would have facilitated trade between Mexico and the U.S., it would have betrayed U.S. consumers by allowing the use of the Dolphin Safe label on tuna caught with methods that are clearly not safe for dolphins, methods that have been responsible for the harassment, injury, and death of millions of these marine mammals. Thanks to Judge Henderson, the Dolphin Safe label will, for now, remain true blue. And the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, which receives thousands of fur items every year from people who have moved on to other types of garments, is sending a shipment of coats to Nebraska Wildlife Rehabilitation Incorporated. There, the furs will serve as bedding material for baby animals, including squirrels, foxes, raccoons, and others. The Omaha-based rehabilitation center is caring for more baby animals than usual due to the higher birth rate in the spring months. The furs will provide bedding for baby animals whose parents, either dead or in need of rehabilitation, cannot care for them. Over the years, the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals has received enormous numbers of coats from people including Mary Tyler Moore, Kimberly Hefner, and Barbara Bach, who do not want to wear the furs after seeing exposés of cruelty to animals caught in leghole traps or driven mad by tiny fur farm cages. People for Ethical Treatment of Animals uses the donated furs in library displays, anti-fur fashion shows, street theater, and other educational events designed to convince consumers that animals should never be fashion victims. PETA has even donated some furs to the truly needy, the homeless, maintaining that only people suffering to survive have any excuse for wearing fur. We can't bring back the animals who have been killed for their skin back, but these coats can bring some comfort to the lives of other fur-bearing animals, says PETA's fur campaign coordinator, Raylene Smith. If you want to donate unwanted furs, call 888-FUR-AWAY. That's 888-F-U-R-A-W-A-Y. And donate those old furs for a good cause. And gray whales are again washing up dead on North America's Pacific coast, but experts said on Wednesday they did not know if this is evidence of a problem or if the whale population has returned to healthy balance. Nearly 30 gray whales have been found dead from California to British Columbia in recent weeks as the mammals make their annual migration from their breeding grounds off Mexico to their summer feeding grounds in the Bering Sea off Alaska. At one time, gray whales had been hunted nearly to extinction, but researchers estimate there are now about 26,000, close to the same number believed to have existed before large-scale commercial whaling began in the 1800s. Trade in the gray whale has been outlawed since 1949, allowing the population to recover. The 273 gray whales found dead last year along their migration route was five times the number normally found, so researchers were not surprised to hear of deaths again this year, said Peter Ross of the Ocean Institute of Ocean Sciences in Victoria, British Columbia. We could be seeing these strandings that they've reached equilibrium in their population, Ross said, but researchers are also concerned the deaths could be a result of environmental changes in the Bering Sea that have caused a drop in the whale's primary food supply, the tiny amphipod crustaceans. The whales, which can weigh up to 36 tons and live as long as 60 years, spend the summer in the Bering's cold waters eating and building up a reserve of fat they live on for the rest of the year. The Bering food supply used by whales and other animals such as sea lions has been dropping for two decades, but researchers don't know why. It may be because whales are beating it down. It may be because of environmental reasons, Shell said. Many of the adult whales found dead last year were emaciated, indicating they had not been able to eat enough to make the journey. Tissue samples have been taken from the animals discovered this year. Scientists are also sampling dead whales' fat for toxins, but Ross, a toxicologist, said he does not believe that pollution is the direct cause of death of the animals discovered so far. Researchers acknowledge that since deaths occur at sea, the carcasses discovered washed ashore represent only a small portion of the actual death toll. He's not too concerned about the state of the gray whale population at the moment. On the other hand, I would be concerned if these sentinels are telling us about the state of the oceans, Ross said. And the world's turtles are still under threat. There are calls for hawksbills turtles to be traded again. This is from environment correspondent Alex Kirby. Almost every species of marine turtle is in danger of extinction, according to the Worldwide Fund for Nature. The group says that despite decades of attempts to save them, six of the world's seven turtle species could disappear. Even stable populations can never be considered completely safe, it says, because of overexploitation and other threats, the World Wildlife Fund is opposed to attempts at the Nairobi meeting of the UN Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species to reopen trade in the tortoise shell. This comes almost exclusively from the hawksbill turtle, which the World Conservation Union describes as critically endangered. Countries urging a trade resumption are Cuba and the Dominican Republic. And Amazon tree loss continues. Brazil says the rate at which its Amazon rainforest is being destroyed is continuing unchanged. A government report said that the 1998-99 illegal logging and farming destroyed forest totaling 130 kilometers square. Satellite imagery revealed the 16,926 square kilometer mile loss. That's about 6,300 square miles. This compares with a loss of 17,000 square kilometers in 1997 and 1998. The area of forest lost during that year was almost a third more than the year before. Until then, the rate had been falling since its peak in 1995, and there were hopes that conservation measures were working. This past year, there has been a strengthened police presence in threatened areas, though it seems to have had little deterrent effect. But the Brazilian government took comfort in the fact that the rate of loss has not increased again. The Environment Minister, José Sarney Filho, said, "The tendency to increase in deforestation has been controlled." But Dr. Norman Myers of Green College, Oxford, told BBC News Online, "It's a worrying trend. 15 years ago, the rate of loss of Amazonia was about half what it is today, assuming the figures were accurate. If it goes on doubling like this, we could be in a lot of trouble before long. It's good news that the rate hasn't increased, but I suspect that it may have less to do with enforcement than with a downturn in the Brazilian economy." And in his most recent report, BC government biologist, that's British Columbia government biologist, whistleblower Dionys Deleu, concludes that, quote, "As a direct consequence of hunting overkill, the British Columbian grizzly bear population as a whole has declined, and unless immediate steps are taken, will continue to decline," he says. He goes on to state that a complete moratorium starting immediately must be placed at the very minimum into the year 2017 and possibly until well after 2050, Deleu warns that British Columbian grizzly bears are declining from ongoing habitat loss and that exacerbating that decline by continuing the grizzly bear hunt is biologically irresponsible. Deleu's research finds that the allowable kill of 300 grizzlies per year established in 1979 was exceeded every year from 1965 to 1997 on average by 236 bears. Deleu estimates that a total of 17,694 grizzlies were killed during his study period. Female grizzly kill was especially excessive, as Deleu reveals the British Columbian government has allowed an extensive female overkill for at least the last 33 years. If you're interested in reading Deleu's latest report on overhunting of British Columbia grizzlies, it is on the Raincoast Conservation Society website. That's www.raincoast.org. And go to the grizzly bear page and scroll down to the sport hunting threat section. This, of course, from the Raincoast Conservation Society, P.O. Box 8663, Victoria, British Columbia, VAW3S2. Once again, that address, the Coast Conservation Society, P.O. Box 8663, Victoria, British Columbia, VAW3S2. Their email, of course, is chris@raincoast.org, and their webpage again, www.raincoast.org. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has denied an application for a scientific collecting permit to kill an unprecedented 2 million blackbirds as part of an experiment to reduce damage to commercially grown sunflowers, a favorite blackbird food, during the late summer and fall. The experiment proposed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animals, Plant, and Health Inspection Service, Wildlife Services, formerly known as Animal Damage Control, or ADC, would use pesticide-laced rice strewn in corn stubble fields to attract and kill 6 species of blackbirds as they migrate north in the spring through sunflower-producing areas in east-central South Dakota. After reconsideration of the APHIS application, it was first denied in February. U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologists have determined there is not sufficient scientific data to support the request. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service found no scientific evidence to suggest that killing the blackbirds in the spring would have any effect on reducing the late summer and fall blackbird population, nor result in any reduction of damage to ripened sunflowers. Because the experiment would use lethal baiting and control method, which has proven to attract many types of birds, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologists were also concerned about the potential risk to other types of migratory birds protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. A particular concern is the potential risk to grassland bird species throughout the northern Great Plains as a group. Grassland bird populations in the U.S. are declining at a faster rate than any other bird species group. We can't permit an experimental action to kill migratory birds when there's no adequate scientific basis to measure whether it will actually reduce sunflower damage. According to Ralph Morgenweck, director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Mountain Prairie Region, in addition, the potential risk of significant mortality to non-target species has not been scientifically assessed or excluded. And a final rule was published by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listing the rare native Hawaiian forest bird Oahu eliapio as an endangered species. The listing comes as a result of a lawsuit brought by the Earth Justice Legal Defense Fund on behalf of the Conservation Council for Hawaii. The Oahu eliapio was once abundant in forested areas throughout Oahu, the Hawaiian island where the city of Honolulu is located. But now an estimated 1,500 birds remain, and the bird now occupies about only 4% of its historic original range. The bird's dramatic decline prompted the service to propose the Oahu eliapio for listing as endangered, but the service then failed to comply with the Endangered Species Act's strict mandate to finalize the proposal within 1 year. And the coelacanth, a living fossil fish once thought to have become extinct with the dinosaurs, has won protection when a UN conference banned all international trade in the species. And the 150-nation conference also agreed to ban the trade in Australia's dugongs, a type of sea cow, and to step up protection measures for Asian box turtles and African spurred tortoises, which are caught wild and sold to the global pet trade. But the proposals to ban a total trade in the species of musk deer and Black Sea bottlenose dolphins were rejected, as was another to regulate the trade in 13 species of tarantula spiders found in India and Sri Lanka. Wild Alabama Biodiversity Legal Foundation and Edward Mudd Jr. filed suit against the Secretary of Interior Bruce Babbitt, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Department of Interior for their failure to list the Alabama sturgeon as an endangered species under the Endangered Species Act. The Fish and Wildlife Service stated it would not make a final decision on the proposal to list the Alabama sturgeon as endangered because it wanted more time to read comments on the proposal, but a decision on the listing proposal cannot legally be delayed for this reason. Alabama has more species of fish than any other state in the nation, yet as this decision by Secretary Babbitt shows, our wildlife and water resource heritage are held hostage to the whims of big polluters who want everything for themselves, said Ray Vaughn, attorney for BLF Wild Alabama and Mr. Mudd. The Alabama sturgeon is the rarest unprotected fish in North America, and if we cannot protect it, what can we protect? If you want more information, send email to wildlaw@AOL.com. That's wildlaw@AOL.com. And according to the Allegheny Defense Project, an extensive bat colony has been found less than 50 miles from the Allegheny National Forest. It includes at least 67 Indiana bats, which were listed as endangered under the Federal Endangered Species Act in 1967. The Allegheny Mineral Corporation applied for a permit to the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection for a 520-acre strip mine. The Pennsylvania Game Commission was sent to investigate the area. The PGC discovered the bats while investigating an old limestone mine underneath the proposed strip mine site. The PGC only surveyed approximately 5% of the mine, so it is possible there's a population of as many as 1,000 bats in the area. You want more information? Contact ADP at 814-223-4996. That's 814-223-4996. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week for news on Earth First Radio. If you want to get news or announcements from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, here it is. Send us email, please. cruzef@cruzio.com. That's C-R-U-Z-E-F at C-R-U-Z-I-O.com. cruzef@cruzio.com. Or send your letters to Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please be sure to send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you'd like more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal, our address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. And you can listen to Earth First Radio on your computer. We're on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radio, followed by the number 4, followed by all.net. You'll need a sound card in your computer, but the software you need to play the MP3 files is free on the website if you don't have it already. Earth First Radio is being carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Be sure to ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio, like WXXE in Syracuse, New York. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Portions of this newscast were prepared with the help of Eon Blues. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. Thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now let's listen to some Robert Hoyt. This one's called Apple Pie.
Just as a man.